Writer Paul Beattie is not someone whose thoughts you want to predict. His latest book, The Sellout, was published in 2015 and last year became the first novel by an American author to win the UK's Man Booker Prize. It is a brilliant, harrowing romp through the ways in which we are imprisoned in America by our history and language, and in some ways, by this very American belief that, hey, we're doing the best we can given our history, folks. Beattie says progress can be a very dangerous drug in America, and he's not a user. Doesn't mean he's negative about everything, but when you talk to him, he's always affectionately deriding himself for going negative. There I go again, he says. I just wanted to talk with him today about all that is swirling around in America right now. It was a good decision, I think. I hope you'll agree.
There's a poet. He's kind of recently passed away, a guy named Amiri Baraka. Uh-huh. He's a smart guy.
Yeah.
And I went to see him read once, and I told 9 million stories about this one reading. But anyways, one of the things he was talking about, you know, in terms of perception, was he's talking about Stephen Fetchett, the quintessential black Hollywood coon, you know. He was talking about Stephen Fetchett, and he's like, you know, you see him in the movies, you know, and his white boss is, you know, whoever's employing him, will go tell Stephen Fetchett, pick up that bucket 40 feet away. Stephen Fetchett would, you know, take 40 minutes to move 40 feet, slow, mumbling, ambling, you know. And Baraka pointed out this thing where he goes, you know, only the most servile person, only the real true sellout is going to run to pick up the bucket. You know, he goes, there's a reason why Stephen Fetchett is taking his time. You know, it's his own kind of way, his own method of subversion. I thought that was so smart and so insightful.
Seeing the defiance in something that's so ostensibly offensive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And ostensibly servile.
Yeah.
You know, and that always really stuck with me. I thought that was just, you know, but that's just one case of many of these things. You know, and I kind of do it with, you know, things that I do in my own life. I'm not that succinct yeah. of a storyteller, so I appreciated that. But, you know, that's like kind of an example of what I'm trying to do a little bit.
A very educated, wonderful person, friend of the show and mine, on the day after the election, said that the election of Trump was a white supremacist result. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, white supremacy is everywhere. It's always has been, you know, might not always will be. I'm not one of those people who thinks that it's just this de facto way that the world is. But for me, the thing I've been, you know, I'm not supposed to talk about this. My wife wants me to write about this. But I think for me, a thing that I haven't worked out that I've been thinking about, it's weird. It's like it's like an example of white self-hatred, which doesn't really get talked about. And in the way that I can relate to self-hatred is this thing about you often do things as a manifestation of that that's often against your own interest. Voting, who you choose as a mate, all these kind of things. How you want to see yourself, how you want other people to see you. You know, this is another weird example. I was really young. I can't remember when this happened, but you remember David Duke running for governor
yeah,
of Louisiana?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was in L.A. I don't know how old I was, but 15, 16, I guess. I don't know. I was at the Keaton's house. We were in their apartment watching the news, and they put the results up. He got, 30% of the white vote, you know, this and that. And at the bottom of the screen, David Duke had got like 6% of the black vote. And I remember my friend Ronald Keaton running up to the television and tapping on the glass going, who are these stupid, you know, who are they? And I was like, yeah, who are they? And for me, that's this self-hatred thing. That's like a small example of this writ large in terms of not just race, gender, a lot of things. Self-hating capitalists, I don't know what it is, but it's this weird thing that I haven't really worked out yet. But that's how it registers to me in a weird way. And the other thing is, I mean, the interesting thing for me is how – I haven't heard much of it now, you know, post the inauguration, but how he kind of – and people didn't mind that he didn't run away from this really staunch white racist support, which is nuts to me. Just on an individual level, how do you not question yourself about mm-hmm. why these people mm-hmm. are mm-hmm. in favor of me? You know, not that he has to change anything, but just – And it was weird. The interesting thing for me, it's not like I paid a ton of attention to this, but I never saw anyone who knew how to even broach the subject, which I thought was really interesting.
No, I mean, it was either you disavow them or you can't play. And he just said, no, wrong. I don't have to do anything. They're supporting me. I don't care.
Yeah, he didn't have to do anything because there was no, you know, we've – you know, this is a nation that hasn't had to be accountable for a lot ever, but is really just blatantly unaccountable for many things, you know, starting with, you know, these wars in the Middle East, the Wall Street crisis. You know, and Trump's kind of running this thing of, hey, you know, and it reads as like this real just unmitigated power in a weird way.
Why didn't things change more during the 8 years of Obama, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think those things changed much, but, you know, things like same-sex marriage, there were some big changes made, you know? So it's not like things didn't change, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm not sure what his job is. I think that's another interesting thing that's happening now is what's this job of the president? Position versus the person. I'm old, I'm jaded, you know? But, you know, maybe that presidency, maybe this is something that has a ripple effect. You know, if, you know, I think about my students, mid-20s, you know, have spent a good portion of their lives with a black president. You know, maybe that has some effect. I don't know.
I just think we have the capacity to be better friends in this country, you know? If for all the violence and horror and terrible history that we've all had, whatever groups we're talking about, we have a better capacity than we think to get along well.
So, I mean, so like, you know, I flew in. I just came in, you know, the other day, and I got out of the airport, you know, international arrival, come through the customs, and there's a team of maybe 10 lawyers out there asking us, me and my wife, you know, did you see anyone who was detained? Did you see anyone, you know, these genuine concern, you know? I was like, oh, I'm great. This is a good thing, you know? And it's whether that team of lawyers over time, does that shrink from 10 to 2, 10 to 1? Does it grow from 10 to 15, 10 to 20? You know, there's a lot of stamina involved in all this, you know? So I'm always thankful for those people who have the stamina to continue having, you know, just as from what you're talking about, these conversations, to continue to be open, to continue to fight and be energetic. It's a rare quality. And so I'm thankful for those people.
Paul Beattie, thanks so much.
John, thanks for having me, man.
Paul Beattie is Man Booker Prize Award winner and author of The Sellout. He's participating in a New York City program called One Book, One New York, a citywide book club initiative that will bring New Yorkers together to read the same book at the same time. The mayor's office is unveiling it today.